This is All In. I'm Miriam Sob. Today marks 1 year since the video of George Floyd's murder was spread across social media and the news. Floyd's story is just one of many that have made headlines and spread across social media. And today we're talking about the toll these repeated stories have on some of the people who see them. If you'd like to join the conversation and have a question or comment, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by three guests. Carrie Dixon is the former president and current treasurer for the Indiana Association of Black Psychologists. Dr. Keno Miller is a licensed psychologist and assistant professor of counseling psychology at Florida State University. And Danielle Henderson is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at IU Health. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with you, Carrie. There have been numerous studies over the years about the impact of traumatic images on developing minds, as well as communities who've been victimized. What happens when stories like George Floyd's and visual evidence of violence are repeatedly presented?
I'm sorry, Marianne, I didn't catch the first part of your question. Would you repeat it?
Yeah, sure. So there have been studies over the years on the impact of traumatic images on developing minds, as well as communities who've been victimized. And so what happens when we have stories like George Floyd's and we have the visual evidence of violence and it's repeatedly presented to us?
What happens emotionally, it's like a situation of traumas that are being relived over and over and over, similar to what would be like post-traumatic stress syndrome. And individuals, particularly African-Americans, have been exposed to this type of violence for hundreds of years. And it's like a generational type of genetic pass down of trauma. And so we may witness these traumatic events, these killings, and become emotionally distraught and may not really realize why we're so upset, mm-hmm. or so emotionally upset or so depressed or so anxious, you know, about those type of things. So what happens is that you become emotionally, on some level, you become emotionally impacted with depression, with anxiety, and just hypervigilance, being, if I can just tell you a quick story.
Yeah,
I was... about five of the Black psychologists were at a luncheon, and we're from different ages, from ages of like late 30s to late 70s. And we all had different levels of arousal, emotional arousal, in reference to these experiences that we have been witnessing, mm-hmm. In reference to police killings of unarmed Black men. And we talked about how we feared for the safety of our boys and our husbands, you know, and if we're approached, and this is the younger ones were saying, that when they see a police officer pull over a Black person, or if they see one behind them, they immediately tense up emotionally. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that has to do not just with what's happening now. Again, that's generations of emotional trauma that is being heightened within us as we see these type of violences.
Right. And I do want to touch on generational trauma a little later. Dr. Miller, sort of a similar question about seeing these images and the impact it has on people. I mean, is this almost akin to living through a war zone daily?
It absolutely is. I typically talk about it in terms of we are at war. It's a psychological war that continues as a physical war that continues and has been perpetuated throughout generations, as Carrie Dixon, Dr. Dixon was saying. And because of that, if we think about excessive hypervigilance, we think about how it activates fight or flight, the response that we naturally will all have. But I talked about this in my class. I taught abnormal psychology at FAMU, and I talked about simply, if you think about fight or flight, at some point one will try to fight. But if that response has been challenged and mitigated, then you're in shock. And then there is the perpetual trauma, the excessive wear and tear on the CNS, central nervous system, heightened cortisol levels, higher levels of allostatic load, and then the increased stress on the heart, hypertension, and then you wonder why Black men and Black women die at earlier rates than any other person in our society. So eventually it has a serious impact on the body. So that is a war type response, if you are thinking about it in those terms. Absolutely.
Right. And Danielle, I'd like to also get your input on this. What do you see the results of this sort of ongoing trauma having on folks?
I think, yes, I definitely agree with everything the other panelists have already shared. I think, you know, you're witnessing a very traumatic event. And as Dr. Dixon was saying, a lot of emotions may arise as you're watching the video or hearing the account of it. Then you take into account, as a Black American, the history that we've had in this country and the history that we've had all over the world when it comes to violence that's been perpetrated against us. And we, a lot of us, you know, regardless of your age, you know stories of people that to which that has happened. And I think, as Dr. Dixon was saying, you know, may have had our own experiences or people close in our family. And so when we watch the videos, it's not just about our emotional experience seeing that person be impacted by violence. It's also thinking about all of the other people to whom or to which this has happened. And so all of those things are kind of happening all together. And again, as both panelists have spoken to, the intergenerational trauma, these stories being passed down to us as part of our history and for our safety and protection are living within us in our bodies. And we, so we will maybe have heightened sense of fear, heightened sense of hyper arousal, like we're, you know, avoiding certain places. And I think, you know, particularly with this topic, and we're thinking about, you know, racial stress and racism with other situations, you know, that might make us anxious or afraid, we can usually find a way to avoid them. So, you know, if we're fearful of public speaking, you know, sometimes we can figure out a way to not have to do that. Or if we're fearful of crowds, you know, we can find a way to not be engaged in a crowd. But when you're thinking about racism and prejudice, those are forces acting on us at all times. And we're not always able to avoid it. And also not really always sure from where that is going to come, which also complicates our experience.
Right. And when we speak about police brutality, Dr. Miller, obviously this is something going on for centuries in this country. We've seen horrific videos over and over. What was it about George Floyd's murder that seemed to have gotten such an overwhelming response and recognition?
In my reflection on that particular piece of video evidence, and to be very clear and transparent, I haven't watched it. I never watched it. I didn't want to watch it. There was no shadow of a doubt of what was happening. There was no doubt, and there could be no other statement as to there is no, why is that person running? Oh, what did they do? Did they have? There was nothing. From all accounts, you were able to watch a lynching. Mm-hmm. And to go back historically as well as in contemporary ways of viewing, ways of speaking on this, we in our society in this particular era, this 21st, I would argue, have not seen a lynching on the streets of the United States. However, we recognize that there are systems in place and there are the remnants of these past traumas and emotional trauma. So for generations before our present group of young adults, this was a wake-up call. This was not post-racial, to quote 2008 with the election of previous former President Obama. We are not there. And this is a stark reminder of how far away from that we are.
And what about the response just globally? It seemed like this also sparked something all over the world that even till now you're seeing movement for Black Lives Matter in places like France.
Yeah. And this is the power of social media as well. This is an opportunity for others of African descent in other nations across the world to really speak to those things that are going on in their countries and come together in solidarity with those of us here, descendants of enslaved Africans in the United States. We are trying to get on the same page, get on code if you have it, in using social media to establish one singular identity. Those who are globally oppressed can find a way to use these networks and these channels to move forward and beyond. But it is really an avenue of finding your voice. So globally, social media has been that type of tool. I think it's a godsend at this point.
Absolutely. Well, Danielle, real quick, before we jump to the break, what are your thoughts on social media usage and how it's helping to spread stories?
No, I think, yes, as Dr. Miller was saying, social media has really helped share stories of the news events, you know, what is happening. We're seeing written accounts of what's happening, also, you know, videos and audio, and then being able to share all of that information incredibly quickly, I think has been, you know, something that has been helpful in spreading the word and bringing awareness to these concerns. And I think also what's been nice to see on social media is it's given people an outlet to share their own experiences or share their reactions to what's going on with a broader audience and reach more people than we probably would have been able to reach prior to the social media era.
Right. Well, we'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about how stories about police brutality, like the murder of George Floyd 1 year ago today, can have an impact on people's mental health. Up next, we'll talk about ways to address those mental health issues. And later, we'll discuss how the media covers these kinds of stories. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about how stories about police brutality, including the murder of George Floyd 1 year ago today, can create trauma and impact the mental health of people who see these things. Before the break, we talked about the video footage of George Floyd's murder and how it impacted people all around the world and what the implications are on the mental health of communities that are repeatedly victimized and traumatized. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us again are Carrie Dixon, former president and current treasurer for the Indiana Association of Black Psychologists, Kano Miller, licensed psychologist and assistant professor of counseling psychology at Florida State University, and Danielle Henderson, assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at IU Health. Carrie, before the break, we were mentioning social media and the role that it's played. I do wonder if you've seen anything in your years of experience that has shown a difference in the way maybe younger folks are dealing with this information and using things like social media versus older generations.
Well, I commend millennials and younger folks with the activism that they have shown in the wake of this, of the George Floyd killing. It kind of reminds me of the 60 movements and the nonviolent protests with Dr. King that my generation went through. So, but in reference to reactions, I think the younger generation is doing a lot more proactively to try to bring about change in reference to institutional racism, you know, within the United States. So I think that was your question. I'm not sure.
No, that's a great answer. Thank you for sharing that with us. Dr. Miller, what about you? Have you noticed that young people are seeing these stories and talking about them that is noticeably in a different way than older generations? Is there more of maybe because there's a platform now, social media sort of somewhat gives people a platform that they didn't have before?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think the ability to quote unquote go live, to film anything and broadcast it in that moment. I once had an idea. I think I lost out on the patent, but a device that you would attach to your rearview mirror, and anytime a police officer approached your car, you hit it and you go live and you broadcast it around the world. Would have been a great thing, maybe, if you think about Brother Philando Castile. But in this particular instance, I think the ability of any moment to push a button and to broadcast real time is huge, critical, because it helps to galvanize and maybe dispute what others would say is or is not authentic. So mm-hmm. I think young people have utilized that technology, the widespread, quote unquote, smartphone, camera phone. This is where our technology is right now. And I think in terms of people being able to tell their multiple truths, I think it is very significant. So this is part of where we're at. And those who have that power in their hand, once they learn how to use it and they have that strong urge to promote truth, I think it's critical where we're at and where we're going.
Right. Well, I do want to move on and talk a little bit more about dealing and coping with some of the emotions that come up with the ongoing brutalization and murders of community members and the trauma that follows. Danielle, how are people coping in communities of color and in the Black community? And what is your advice to those who aren't sure how they should cope?
No, I think that's a really excellent question. I think people are coping in a variety of ways. In the earlier segment, Dr. Miller had mentioned that he has not watched the video of George Floyd. And I think that is one way of coping when we learn about some of these instances, maybe not looking up the video or really trying to monitor what you're reading and consuming about it, and maybe even, you know, conversations you're having about it, really trying to be mindful of that. I think that's one approach to it. I think also people are reflecting on faith and spirituality, again, not just with the police violence, but just everything that's happened this year and how it's impacted physical and mental health and lives for so many people. Practicing spiritual faith, making sure, you know, you're integrating that back into your day has been one way people are coping. Talking about it, I know I was just saying before, people being mindful of how much they're talking about it. But again, I think this has been a nice opportunity for people to be able to share their own emotions and maybe even personal experiences with police violence. Whereas before, it maybe felt uncomfortable to do that, or people were maybe uncertain about the response they would get or any kind of support. And I think also just trying to, another way too, is educating. This has been another great time where people are hearing things that they may not have heard before and hearing about experiences that might not be the same as what they've experienced. And so some people have been coping by really trying to dig in to meaningful literature and educate themselves on these topics so that they can use that information, hopefully, towards activism change.
And, you know, I often wonder in the mental health field, when folks are struggling and they're looking for help, how important it is to have representation. And I know there's been an emphasis on pushing for more representation when it comes to communities of color, and in particular, the Black community. So how important is it when seeking mental health help to have the person treating you come from a similar background, Carrie?
For many people, it makes all the difference in the world as far as establishing rapport and being able to connect with the client and the caregiver, the mental health therapist. If the person, the therapist, understands your plight, and is able to empathize with your plight, then I think that is a sense of comfort that will allow the client to open up more readily. Therapists, in my opinion, need to understand the culture of the people that they're treating. So if you're from a different cultural background, or even if you're from the same cultural background, you may need to understand something about the culture of your client in order to be able to relate effectively to your client, in order to develop a effective alliance with that client. So being culturally competent is extremely important in helping to move your client forward out of whatever emotional devastation they're experiencing in order to get them to become more enlightened as to how they can move forward, you know, in their emotional trauma. Mm-hmm. So cultural competence, I think, is extremely important.
And Dr. Miller, on that same note, are you seeing a shift at all in the way mental health issues in the Black community are being treated? Is there still a need for more resources?
Absolutely. I'm seeing a need for more resources. But to Dr. Dixon's point, cultural competency is huge. First of all, is reducing stigma and getting people in the door. And we've seen other businesses or resources mimic this. We've seen an emphasis and a push to train more Black doctors. Why? Because they'll likely go back to those communities and serve those communities and increase health utilization. It's the same thing for his mental health. We recognize that there is significant lag in training of professionals who look like the communities we serve. And so the reality is we've got to do a better job of increasing the pipeline. But more importantly, for our providers who don't come from these communities, we have to make sure that the language is equitable. We have to make sure that we are meeting the needs. So what we call cultural competency, cultural responsiveness, we want to make sure we are engaging at all levels to bring this community into the fold. We recognize that those who've been highly traumatized over years and generations typically are the ones who are not seeking the service. You can look at all of the discussion around the COVID-19 vaccine. Mm-hmm. And healthcare providers were trying to line up to argue against it, but you cannot argue against Tuskegee. You cannot argue against cultural mistrust. And therefore, I'd have some disagreement around putting faces who look like ours in front of us to say, oh, yes, it's safe, because what we really understand is all skin folk and kin folk. So in this particular argument, we have to, because you are melanated, does not make you a qualified practitioner.
You still have to
engage the community and be willing to listen. And that is a skill that takes a great deal of training and practice.
Right. You know, I really appreciate you saying that. I mean, I never even thought of it from that lens. I think, you know, people just keep thinking if we just keep pushing these different things and people will follow. But that's a really good point. Danielle, when we look at ways to address the psychological impact on folks who are affected by traumatic stories and images and things, is there a way to reduce some of the trauma? And I guess what I'm also wondering is what role do news outlets play in reducing some of that trauma?
I think first, when I think about your question, I think the first response I have is an accurate, thorough analysis is the word that comes to mind, but that's not what I want to say. But getting a thorough history and assessment, that's the word, of what exactly is going on. Like we've touched on it, you know, people may be experiencing trauma symptoms, anxiety, depression, a whole host of other, you know, mental health presentations. So really getting a thorough assessment of what is going on, and that can help guide what our treatment looks like. And also, I think, again, as, you know, practitioners, we can sometimes fall into our assessment techniques and looking at different measures. And we might be hitting at something, but we might also be missing something by not taking into, you know, full account what the client or patient is thinking about their presentation and what's going on. You know, they might have a different perspective on their experience. And I think it's important to listen to that as well. And so, you know, to your next point about media outlets, again, like we've talked on, you know, there's a wealth of information out there. The information is presented in a wide variety of ways. And you know, we never quite know, like we're talking about, we never quite know the experiences that people may have had and how they might be responding to the media presentation. And so I do think it is important to, you know, present the story, but keeping all of these things in mind that people are being impacted by what's going on and how it's being presented, and trying to be careful and mindful of that when we think about mental health.
Mm-hmm. I do want to touch up a little bit on generational trauma. We kind of briefly mentioned it in the first segment. Dr. Dixon, can you tell us a bit more about what that phrase means?
I'm not the expert, but I'll tell you what little I do know, and that is trauma that our ancestors experienced during the beginning of enslavement, being captured out of their homeland in Africa, transported across you know, the Atlantic Ocean, through the Middle Passage, and all of that trauma that came with the horrors of enslavement, all of those memories are impacted in our DNA. Mm-hmm. And they're passed on from one generation to the next generation to the next generation. So when I say that when we become heightened alert at the presence of violence coming from particularly white police officers, we're experiencing the violence that our ancestors experienced. We're still reliving that type of trauma because it's embedded in our DNA and passed on to us. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times we have a reaction and we don't know why our reaction is so heightened. It's because we're reaching back into, you know, the heightened trauma of our ancestors. We're experiencing their trauma at the present while we're experiencing the present trauma.
I do want to ask a little bit about sort of the news's role. Dr. Miller, when you see stories like George Floyd's and how it's talked about in the news and national conversations, do you think the coverage is getting things right, or are there improvements that need to be made? Is it furthering the trauma, or is it enabling people to understand what's going on?
Great question. Are you able to hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. Great question. I look at things from a perspective of how do we market things? Marketing minor, undergraduate, loved it, but media has the ability to cast light on some instances and maybe even at times trivialize those instances. So I think in this particular instance, I don't know. This is how we have a Fox News and we have an MSNBC. There's a way to take one image and peel it back this way and then move it to this way where it looks like shadows. You know, it is very interesting to see how things are being cast in the media. I think ultimately when we look at a picture, it's worth a thousand words, as I like to say. But when you put the narrative around it, that helps to write the script. And we understand that the hunter versus the lion, who gets to tell the tale? And so who is underwriting that particular message? I always ask myself, there's a new show on Amazon. I won't publicize it, but I watched the first episode and I want to know who produced this. Mm-hmm. Why was this made? And that's what I want to know. Who is behind this product? Because there are times where something could seem very genuine, but depending on the intent, it may tell a different story.
Absolutely.
And that's how I've come to view media.
So do your research and see who's behind everything.
Absolutely.
Well, I we're going to have to get ready to close out, but Danielle, I want to end with a quick note from you. for folks who may have been triggered by this conversation or who are looking to cope with what's going on, is there any resource that you can recommend?
Yes. And so I know we're short on time. I think one big thing is talking to people you know about what's going on with you, what you're experiencing, talking to them and getting their guidance on maybe it's time to meet with a mental health provider, asking them if they have recommendations. You can also look online for different resources of providers in your community, as Dr. Dixon had talked about, thinking about characteristics of your provider that are important to you and finding that fit and that match. And then there are also some online options that are really great as well. Biggest message is if you're in need of help, there is quality, competent care available to you and providers willing to give you what you deserve.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us this afternoon. We really appreciate it. We'll be back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soh. Back now to our discussion on the impact that stories like the murder of George Floyd, which happened a year ago, have on the people who see them. As always, you can contribute with your questions or comments. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now, we have two guests to talk about the media's role in covering stories of police violence and the protests around them. Rod Hicks is Director of Ethics and Diversity for the Society of Professional Journalists, and Danielle Kilgo is a Cowles Professor of Journalism, Diversity, and Equality at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Minnesota. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Miriam.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Danielle, you've done work looking at how the media covers protests. I want to start with that. What are some of the most interesting things you've seen or maybe alarming?
I think that when we look at how news media covers protests, the mainstream media is mostly what I'm talking about here, is that it's very different for Black civil rights protests than other protests. So we're talking about different coverage patterns, different language used when we're talking about these civil rights protests than compared to other protests like the Women's March. But the coverage of these protests tends to actions much more than it does the substance. And that's what a lot of news audiences end up walking away with. That is a narrative that talks about people out in the streets, people engaging in particular activities, whether radical or not, people's emotions and drama. And then there's little room left for, in this sort of overall pattern of news coverage, there's little room left for more conversation about the substance that brought people there, the things that they're advocating for, the agendas and grievances that they have. That part of things tends to not show up regularly in the overall coverage that we see about protests like Black Lives Matter.
Have you noticed any changes in the way media has been covering protests over the years?
It's pretty persistent, honestly. I mean, there's some great evidence of reporting that is just phenomenal and really gets at the heart of the issue. And my work really looks at sort of these overall patterns. So when you look at it, when you look at an entire news organization's production of coverage, even with those one or two really, you know, invested products or projects, what narratives come out? And no, it's been very consistent since 2012. This just exaggeration in many cases of some of the actions, the extension of conversations about protesters engaged in, for example, like violent behavior or deviant behavior. Those are talked about much more often than they are than some of just the substance of the of the protest. Over time, things have changed in terms of thinking about like police behavior during protests, but that hasn't really revolutionized sort of what journalists have found most newsworthy on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Rod, when you see the way that media covers protests, do you see that it has any effect on how a particular news outlet may be perceived by audiences?
Definitely. I think that a lot of people look at coverage and have in their minds, you know, the motivations of the news organizations and how they go about covering it. But if a protest is covered appropriately or properly, it will include the reason that people gathered and everything that led up to it, and the substance of the story of what was being protested about. However, if somebody torches a police station, or if 50 people tear down the glass walls in a store and rush in and start stealing things, it's hard to ignore that. So the story should be complete. It should have that, but it should also have the underlying reason for the protest. And that's what journalists who do it right will capture. And they'll capture, I want to add, they'll capture with sensitivity and, of course, accuracy and fairness.
Now, Danielle mentioned earlier just about, you know, some of these things can be exaggerated and kind of we lose focus and we focus on other things. Do you think it's fair to say that, Rod, that drama sells, unfortunately, and that can often overshadow a real issue?
That is true. And I think that particularly if you have images, particularly video images of something dramatic, that's probably going to play really prominently in a broadcast. But again, you have to balance that against the underlying reason for the protest, and that mm-hmm. can't be ignored. And you know, the best journalists will make sure that story is told with all of the appropriate context.
Right. And I appreciate that you're saying the best journalists would do that. But I think sometimes there's, a routine or a habit, like breaking news. You just go there, you're reporting every 5 minutes from the same scene, and it's whatever dramatic thing happened there. How do journalists make sure that they don't fall into that trap?
They have to make a conscious decision not to. They also need to have some type of editor to give it a back read or another look to try to make sure that it's not, dramatic photographs, and that there is the full story is being told. And there are editors who do that, and it really needs to be done more. But, mm-hmm. Realistically, there is a temptation to show the dramatic images, because it draws people in, and it's people like drama.
Right. I think we see whenever there's a big story that becomes a national story, suddenly everyone and every outlet converges upon that area to do their live reports around the clock. And I often wonder if that elevates a story to a level that I don't know if it's always necessary. I mean, I guess it's case by case.
It is case by case, but people who, well, the broadcast outlets that do, round the clock coverage of one issue or extended coverage of one issue, there's a challenge in doing that. It's has anything really new happened? And mm-hmm. and unfortunately, a lot of times with that type of coverage, the what's happening can be distorted because you may repeat some of the things that have already happened because nothing else has happened, and that may be given too much attention to that one aspect.
Right. And Danielle, I want to ask you sort of similar in that vein of that. Have you seen that overextended coverage of stories over and over and over distorts the message at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think what it does is it does exactly what you said earlier, that it's drama and it sells. And I think that it does capture people's attention and also feeds, pre-existing ideas and stigmatizing narratives that help people feel like they're right about particular issues. But I think that having been on the ground here in Minneapolis for a year now and been able to, regularly see what some of the activists are doing, I think that that narrative is not the stronghold of what's going on, and that there's also, drama and sensationalism built into, the trauma that they're experiencing, the reasons that they're out there in the streets. It goes much, it goes beyond George Floyd. There's been several cases here in the Twin Cities, and tons of cases we haven't heard about at a national level. And so I think that there's definitely a distortion of the narrative in terms of not getting the whole picture as a news audience, because the things that they think are happening, or the things that are given worthiness in terms of newsworthiness, aren't necessarily the things that are like agendas and you know, ideas about reform that the activists are constantly meeting to try to implement and to get across to other people.
Do you think there's been enough thought into how stories on police brutality are covered with regards to the impact that it may have on audiences, for example, like the disturbing images and stuff like that? Is there a push for being more conscientious about what journalists are putting out?
Sure. I think that there is now a greater awareness of the traumatic, experiences people have when they watch these images. I think, you know, newsrooms and news organizations are now trying to evolve to figure out, well, how do we use these images so that we can inform our audience of what's going on without, you know, evoking that trauma within those who don't need to see it anymore. You know, we've seen these videos for years. George Floyd wasn't the first. Mm-hmm. And they've hurt people for years. And so I think that there are conversations, and we saw that, especially after the Adam Toledo case, seeing people stop the video right before the death of Adam there. And I think that these are opportunities for journalism to evolve and to think about, you know, niche audiences and what they need and how we can serve, you know, multiple facets of society.
I know there's a lot of conversation going on in newsrooms across the country on how to cover police killings of folks. And Rod, I'm wondering, what are some of the most significant ethical considerations journalists have to make when covering something like a police shooting?
I do want to mention that SPJ has a code of ethics. It's sort of a guidance for journalists on how to cover news events in an ethical manner. And one of the items says to avoid pandering to lurid curiosity, even if others do so. That addresses this issue of, how certain images might be disturbing. And you've seen places where, videos are blurred or they're stopped at certain points. And often there's a note that says, you know, something graphic is about to be shown. So, you know, if you don't want to see that, turn away. So there are efforts to do that. But also what our code tells us is that we have to be, one of the things that we have to do is to minimize harm in our coverage. We don't want to make any situation worse. We have to balance the right and need for people to know against any other things that might bring harm to both reporters or particularly to the audience that we're showing. For example, that is a debate about whether the faces of protesters should be shown in images because of the potential for certain protesters to be targeted. And, you know, some news organizations have decided that they will try to shoot pictures at an angle that doesn't identify people or blur people or do, wide angles so that no particular face could be shown. But others believe that others don't go that far. So it's still a debate within journalism as to, you know, which way you do. But mm-hmm. those are just a couple of things that guide journalists and how they cover events like this.
Well, when we talk about trust in media and news outlets, what would you say is sort of where people are at right now? Is there a lot of trust, or are we still trying to gain back trust of audiences?
Miriam, trust in the news media has been on a downward trend since the mid-1970s. It sort of peaked around Watergate, and ever since then, it's been downhill. Right now, or in the last survey by Gallup, 60% of Americans have little or no trust in the news media. And among Republicans, that number is 89%. So, you know, there's a real issue there. And in the last year, there's been somewhat of a tiny, almost insignificant recovery but still trust is really, really bad. And that's why issues of ethics are important. You know, one of the things that people say that they don't like about the media is that reporters or even entire news organizations have a bias, and they promote that bias. They use their platform to promote their bias. We need to be sensitive of that and examine ourselves as journalists and ask, am I showing my bias in this report? And if we are, then don't do it or come at it a different way. That's one of the biggest things that turns people off about journalists.
Right.
And let me just say, some of that is, I'm not suggesting that the audience is always right about that, because if you look for something, you may find it. Or if you have a strong opinion, nothing that someone says might, you know, satisfy you. You may always see a bias, but it is a legitimate complaint, and journalists should do what they can to address it.
And I think with social media, there are a lot of folks that are going there to get their news. Danielle, what is the impact of that? Or I guess, what are you seeing with folks who may not trust traditional media moving towards social media? Is that a good move?
I'm sorry, the last part of your question came out there. I apologize.
No, that's all right. It's the glitches of these online internet meetings. So I guess what I'm wondering is how much is social media playing in folks sort of leaving traditional news to go there to get their information? And is that even a viable source?
I mean, social media does a lot of things, and how people understand news has changed because we've introduced social media. And that's really complicated how we deal with the issue of media trust. You know, people think that the things that they see on social media constitute as news, and then conflate that with what journalists produce. And that's really challenging for journalists to have to try to combat with their own coverage when people believe, you know, that things that commentators say or things that just, you know, their friends, neighbors said, that journalists said, you know, all of these things are mixed and matched and put together algorithmically on social media sites. And I think that people are well within their rights to be confused about what news is and what it is. I think that we have a huge challenge on our hands in dealing with how both, you know, evolution of journalism, even if we change our standards, we're more equitable, we're more accurate, we're more fair to all communities. How that's going to continue to work within an environment that has all of these different voices and spaces to sort of counterbalance that. So I think that social media really just created a challenging atmosphere for us to have this, you know, congregation of media that kind of can and does counter serve narratives of truth on a regular basis.
Well, thank you so much. I want to thank you both for joining us on the program today. Rod Hicks is Director of Ethics and Diversity for the Society of Professional Journalists. And Danielle Kilgo is a Cowles Professor of Journalism, Diversity, and Equality at the Hubbard School of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Minnesota. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yace, and Scott Cameron is our Managing Editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.